All right, the other side of the tape, I was just starting to say, I think we're running out of tape, and in fact, we did at just at that point. So let's pick up here on the other side. Please continue.
Well, as I was saying, the pilot that I had was an old Canadian crop duster, and we really enjoyed him. And what he liked to do after we'd drop our bombs there in Arizona, off in the distance a lot of time were some big, high cumulus clouds. And he used to love to head for those clouds and fly around in the caverns in those clouds, which was quite interesting. He wasn't supposed to be doing it, but we all liked it anyway.
I see. Well, another thing I wanted to check with you is you mentioned on your first mission the unsettling experience of seeing your bomb bay awash in gas spewing all over, and you managed to make it back without having a spark blow the whole thing up. And then you mentioned one time during my summer internship that you got hit by a piece of flak that set you back into the aircraft, which fortunately you had a flak vest on, and mm-hmm. I just was wondering any more comments you might have about that particular incident.
Well, the mission, I don't recall, but and I don't even remember when we started. We flew a few missions, and then it wasn't long till we got these flak vests, and they were kind of they were cloth-covered kind of armor plating-like. They weren't all that heavy, but it was a tough type metal-like, and luckily, by having that on, and I don't know what the mission was exactly, but we had a real close burst of flak. It didn't break out my window in front of me. It just knocked a hole in it because it was a plexiglass material, and it just didn't shatter or anything. But it knocked the hole out, and the thing came in and hit me right in the chest in this flak suit and knocked me back in my seat. It was hit that hard, but it didn't hurt me a bit. It just bounced down on the floor after it hit my flak suit.
Well, how big of a piece hit you?
Oh, it was probably a half inch by an inch, something like that, because those they'd use fragmentation type shells, you know, and they just when they went off, then it would just shatter the shells, like kind of like a anti-personnel bomb, yeah.
And I believe you said you carried that with you for some time?
Yeah, I carried that piece of flak with me for a long time and finally lost it. It was rough on the edges, and I think I wore a hole in my pocket and lost it someplace. But and then no too many close calls. I saw some planes hit pretty good. Well, we hadn't been flying too long, and in going into the target area, going to the coast of France, we started going just straight into a target. Well, in with a lot of respect that they gained from us, German anti-aircraft gunners were no slouches. I mean, about twice they picked off the lead plane in our group. And so after that, then they decided they'd better use a little evasive action when they hit the coast of France. And because they were accurate. And like I say, because of using evasive action and being able to see the guns flash, we were able to avoid an awful lot of it. However, the one time, which was so close too, was it was a reprisal raid, the U-boat pens at Imoyden, Holland. Before we got there, there had been a few B-26s, and 10 planes had made a raid on the U-boat pens at Imoyden, Holland. None got back to England. So this was a reprisal. And we were sending a pretty good squadron in. I'm not sure whether it was all 36, at least an 18-ship squadron. And our squadron commander was leading with our crew. He liked our crew anyway. Well, it is with the enlisted crew. He liked our engineer, radio operator, and turret gunner. And he had the crew, was leading, and I was following in the number two as the backup bombardier with another crew. And just before we were getting into Holland, he took a burst of flak, which was right behind the right engine nacelle. It just blew off the whole engine nacelle because I was right behind him when I saw it. And because of the impact there, it blew into the side of the plane. It immediately killed my engineer, who was on the waist guns. He's usually in the tail, but a first pilot was in the tail so he could keep a tight formation and call to the other ships. It killed him. My top turret gunner was in the turret, and it tore an elbow off of him. The radio operator was okay because he was sitting at the radio in the radio compartment. It was mostly to the rear of the plane. And we saw the plane, and we thought it was going down. Well, finally, after we found out later on that the pilot, the squadron commander, had pulled it back up, and it had killed the one engine, but the problem was that he could not feather the prop. It was just windmilling and dragging him. But he did manage to bring it back. He said he would have ditched it and bailed out, but because of Bob, our turret gunner, who was hurt, he said the other two men were dead anyway, it wouldn't have mattered. But he wanted to get Bob back to England. So he flew it back to England and landed it. And when they did land it, they junked it. I mean, it was too far gone to even try to fix. And I think he did finally get a Silver Star for bringing that plane back. But and that was, it was pretty close. But really, we didn't get much of the flak for some reason or other. It all hit into his plane because I was right behind him.
On that one particular raid. And so you were saying those were crew members that you had been...
Yeah, they were basically our crew that he had used.
Your crew, and because you were playing a different role in that particular mission than usual, you weren't with that...
No, I wasn't with that crew or my co-pilot either. I had a different pilot and co-pilot and crew. I was just by myself, too, with another crew that day.
Were those guys with fly? Did they fly with you all that long before they were killed? Or?
Yeah, because, see, that was the crew that we trained with in Florida.
Oh, really?
Yeah. They were our original crew. But for some reason, they were all good. A radio operator could bang out the code. I mean, he was good, and the engineer was an excellent engineer. The turret runner was a good shot. And the squadron commander just kind of liked the kids, that's all. They were just nice boys, and he took them quite often and would give us another crew.
So you said the engineer got killed, the top turret gunner was badly injured with his elbow. And did you say another person was?
There was a first pilot, another pilot that was riding in the tail.
Riding in the tail, and he got killed.
He was acting as tail gunner, and he got killed because the squadron commander, I mean, in order to watch behind and keep a tight formation, he wanted planes to fly in tight. I mean, we'd fly with our wing a foot apart from another plane, I mean. And he wanted a tight formation because when we drop our bombs, which we found out later on didn't do any good anyway, we dropped 1,000-pound bombs. Those U-boat Panzermeiden were heavily reinforced concrete where they'd put the submarines into. And we thought we could break them up, but obviously after we got reports back, we really didn't do much damage as it was. So,
just such thick concrete that you're bouncing ping pong balls.
It's about 1,000-pound bombs. Yeah, it really didn't do much good.
Go ahead.
Well, I was going to say then, other than that, most of our targets, which you might be interested in, we did a lot of railroad yards. We called them marshaling yards, you know, where they would make up trains and so forth. We hit a lot of those, and we hit a lot of airports around. And also, that time earlier in the war, they had the old buzz bomb, the V-2s, as they call them. You know, it was like Maytag Messerschmitts, we call them, because it was just like a little Maytag wash machine engine on them. They'd put so much gas in them, would get it over England, and then when it ran out of gas, it would just come down. You didn't know where they'd hit or what they'd hit. They'd hit a lot of London.
So were you hitting both V1 sites as well as V2 sites?
Yeah,
both types, both the buzz bomb V1s and the rocket V2s.
Yeah.
You were trying to...
Yeah. The first rockets, I forget what we were doing. There were a bunch of us just kind of outside our barracks one day. And we heard a kaboom, and her pant legs rippled, and we said, boy, that was a big one close by. Where was that? It was a couple days later we found out it was the V1. It hit like 15 miles away from us, and it rippled our pants legs. They were powerful. Well, they'd take out a city block in London when they'd hit, yeah.
Oh, well, as I recall, of course, the V1s were the mini plane types that they could have a chance of shooting down, but the V2, of course, would come screaming in, and there was no way to defend against that.
Well,
because it was coming through that.
Well, the B-1 was the rocket type. Now the B-2 was the MiG-type Messerschmitt. They shot a lot of those down. Fighters could shoot those down because they wouldn't go very fast. Like I say, just a little putt-putt engine on them, and you could hear them coming. And I know we'd sit in the barracks there and hear those silly things, and about the time we'd hear that putt-putt-putt quit, everybody'd duck under the bed because it was coming down.
Well, I guess just to review, you talked about the close calls with the Bombay, with the fuel, and you know, getting hit by the piece of flak. Was there any other missions where you thought, like, uh-oh, this is another close call?
Excuse me. Not too particularly, no.
Of course, how many run-ins with potential demise do you want to have?
Well, that's it, too, yeah. And, no, it wasn't. In fact, I know my dad, came back later on. And, in fact, when I got home, my old high school principal or something, Dad asked him, he says, "What did you teach my kid when he was in school?" He wrote home and he says, "The war is a monotonous thing over there." Which, in a way, it was. Really, it was, in a way, because after a while, you got up in the morning and you got dressed and went to a briefing and flew a mission. And it did get boring.
Well, that actually was a question I hope to raise, and this sounds like a good time. Your typical mission day, you know, in other words, when you got up, when you briefed, when you've had engine start, how your typical duration of a mission, which I know there's going to be variations naturally, and then upon, you know, return, your debrief, would you kind of run down the...
Well, so many, they would get us up fairly early in the morning, always, it seemed like, for a briefing. And
now you're getting up at what time?
Oh, sometimes it's 3 o'clock in the morning or so.
Was that you? What would you say? What was the usual time?
Oh, a lot of times around six or so.
Six or so, and then you'd brief at roughly.
And brief. That'd give us time because we could hear the jeeps running around. They'd take you to the mess hall and then take you to the briefing room, and if you weren't on a mission that day. You'd always know the day before if you were going to have to go on a mission that day or not.
You'd know you'd have to go. Of course, you wouldn't know any details.
No, that's
yet.
It. Yeah. No, yeah. But you know if it was your time to go. And, you'd have no idea where you were going or why. But you could hear the jeeps running, picking up guys and taking them to the mess hall or the briefing room. And so sometimes early. And I don't know, briefings would last, they'd give us pictures and drawings of the target area, and then the weatherman would always give us a forecast of the type of weather we could expect, and they'd show us all our landfall, you know, where we were going, our IP, or initial point, as they called it. That's when you turned on your target area. And an hour or so for a briefing, probably, and then by the time everybody got to their planes and got lined up, we'd take off usually, three on a runway. There'd be one plane ready to lift off or right at the end of the runway, and one would be timed to be about the middle of the runway, and then the third plane would be gunning its engines ready to take off, ready to get on the runway. And that's the way we would take off for our formations and make one circle, and we always flew in boxes of six. So that by about one circle of the field, and you'd have your box made up and be ready to take off and go. And the most, in a V-26, about the most we could fly was 4 hours. It's all the fuel we had. Because that's one reason we bombed mostly France, Belgium, and Holland. One time, I don't know what it was, a railroad yard or something, just over the line into Germany. They just gave us one to say we'd bomb Germany, mainly. But most of them, about 4 hours. And the one thing, too, that sometimes we would fly late. And, in fact, I remember a couple times we landed at 11:30 at night in broad daylight in England. it's that far north. I mean, that is one thing I was going to say too. When we were in Greenland, it was funny. You know, you'd meet a guy in the morning, maybe going to the latrine or something, and he'd say, "You're getting up or going to bed?" Because when we were in Greenland there in May of that year, the sun would go down about a half an hour. When you wouldn't see it, otherwise you'd see the sun. It'd be maybe, like 3 o'clock in the morning or so, it'd dip for about a half an hour, and that's it. Otherwise, it's broad daylight all the time.
Now, you said the most you could fly was 4 hours. Your mm-hmm. usual mission took about how long?
That or less, like 4 hours or less, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay. I was just wondering if the longest was 4 hours, if you more often found yourself flying, say, 2 hours or 3 hours.
Well, about three, mainly, yeah.
Three, typically? Okay.
To get into France or Holland was the longest, really, to get up there, and then we'd come back across the North Sea. You'd have more over-water flights. Now, to some places in France, 20 miles there, I mean, it wouldn't take long to... We were only, 50 miles from our target sometimes, yeah.
Now, you mentioned flying in boxes of six aircraft,
mm-hmm.
and I seem to recall, again, from one of our previous discussions, you mentioned how very often, since not every aircraft would have a trained bombardier, that you'd have a toggler,
right.
there,
mm-hmm.
if you could explain how that worked.
Well, what they do, there would be a bombardier in the lead plane of the six. There'd be one forward, two on each wing, and then another one behind in the center, one on either side of him, which make up the box of six. So the lead bombardier would have the sight and bomb, and then as soon as the bomb dropped, the other fellows, sometimes just non-coms, would be sitting there as toggle ears, and they'd hit the toggle switch to release the bombs. And after a few times at that, then they realized that there was that little delay. So they gave the lead plane a couple of the little old blue sand practice bombs that we always used. And when he released his bombs, those practice bombs would come out, and that gave the fellows a chance to hit their toggle switch so that their bombs would be dropping at the same time the lead bombs were, and it may be a much better pattern.
So the lead plane would have the trained bombardier, and the other five in the box, they might have a trained bombardier,
yeah,
in the back, but they, of course, are all working off the lead's,
yeah, uh-huh, yeah.
signal. And would you say most often those other five aircraft had a gunner or some other person actually?
Yeah, most of the time, yeah.
Because
uh-huh.
bombardiers weren't so plentiful that
no,
you would have
no,
one.
Uh-uh,
and,
no,
and,
uh-uh, no, no.
Uh-huh. And... Now, a squadron at that time, you typically had how many bombers assigned to a
well,
squadron?
Well, each squadron would have 18, usually. Three boxes of six.
And then the group then would be three squadrons.
You could, we very seldom, well, as a group, I think a couple times we flew a 36-plane group.
So, in other words, the three squadrons would uh-huh. provide the 36
yeah, uh-huh,
aircraft,
yeah.
but of course each of them have about 18 aircraft
yeah, uh-huh.
in various states of mission readiness.
Oh, yeah, uh-huh, yeah.
So, but 18 aircraft to a squadron
because
assigned.
Because it was a matter of really all assigned one target, so you wouldn't get the pattern with many more planes than that, unless, you know, it was a big one. If it was a big marshaling large or something, then maybe, or a big airport, maybe they'd send 36 in, but not often. We'd more than likely bomb 18, mostly 18s.
You usually, okay, boxes of six, totaling 18 aircraft.
Yeah, uh-huh, yeah. Yeah.
Was the typical package, you might say,
yeah,
of going on.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I'm also very interested to hear more comments about the threats you faced. I mean, you mentioned how fighter opposition wasn't so much because you always had good escort presence with either the Spitz or the P-51s or the P-47s, mm-hmm. so that the fighters didn't often bounce you all that mm-hmm. often. Although the flak, of course, was very accurate if you, you know, naturally you made your adjustments to do that. Did you find any other threats? Was there much to what extent was there concern that if you got shot down, what your POW treatment might be?
Not a lot. We were given some articles. At one time, we had some pictures taken that we could put on forged passports, and we carried those with us. And then we were given instructions too, like particularly as bombardiers, if we were shot down, the first thing you did, you carried a 45 automatic with you all the time with a bomb sight, and your first shot would be to blow up the bomb sight.
The Norden bomb sight, yeah. Which was considered a very
top secret.
Yes.
Top secret. Yeah.
So the instructions were to put it. How many shots? Just
one would usually do it. They told us where to do it. Would be there's a gyroscope in there, and to hit that basically, which would just about wreck the sight, so that it couldn't be copied. There were some captured, as I understood later on. They did, but I don't know if they've ever got anything out of them or not, really. But it was a thing. In fact, all through cadet school, when we first started into school, you drew your bomb sight, and then they automatically drew a 45 along with it. And you had to have top secret clearance in order to be a bombardier also. I mean,
now, and you said the POW treatment, you didn't have too many?
Weren't too many. We had a couple of planes go down, and in France particularly, since France was very friendly to us, we had some fellas walk home. We called it walking home because the French people would shuttle them from one group to another and walk them across the Pyrenees Mountains in the south into Spain.
Did you say a couple of guys or a couple of crews?
Well, crews.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And we had a few, and one thing that if you were ever shot down and walked out, you were sent home. You couldn't go back into combat again because they'd get you as a spy if you went back. Yeah, you'd be shot on sight as a spy if they found out who you were. But I only remember just a couple of crews walking out.
Now, you said you lost. Well, I'm not sure exactly how much losses your unit suffered. To what extent did that occur?
Oh, not greatly. We'd have some individual crews, and a few individual people were hit.
Where the aircraft makes it back, but sometimes
lose part of the crew.
Dead crewmen.
Lose part of the crew. I want to show you this after a while too.
Oh, you have an article about the B-25 hitting the Empire State Building.
Yeah, very good friend of mine. Yeah, slipped right across the hut.
He was on that B-25, huh?
B-26. Or the AT? Well, no, it was a A-46 transport plane, or C-45 transport. Yeah, C-45. It was an Army transport that he was on. Yeah, C-45.
Oh, in other words, the cargo version of a B-25. Is that right?
I don't think so. More like the DC-3.
Let me just take a look at that article that you're referencing here. That's because I didn't realize it says here C-45 transport. Detroit News article dated 20 May 1946.
Uh-huh.
Saying here, Army C-45 transport into the offices of Atlas Corporation and the Bank of Manhattan on the 58th floor, which I just thought that Empire State Building incident. So, any event, we'll take a look at that and see about that incident.
Mm-hmm. But I was trying, somewhere in here is a list of deceased.
Well, in other words, you didn't come back that many, you didn't have the idea of seen empty bunks and empty places?
No,
no, were
not that many. I have to say, we, you know, when it was all over, like we said, we decided that the B-26 was a pretty safe airplane, really. Yeah.
Now, to what extent did you?
Here they are.
You have.
Okay, this is 42 to 45.
The casualties of the 556th Bomb Squadron, casualties.
That's our squadron, yeah.
From 42 to 45, and I'm looking at a page here with, starting from February 43 to April 45, and there looks to be at least, I'd wager, four dozen names listed here.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, of course, I don't have an exact number, and the exact number is not. There's no total
list. No, I don't think they
here, specifically counting them. And actually, I turn the page and I see it goes to May of 45, and there's appears to be about another dozen names there.
Yeah.
So maybe I should make a copy of some of these things just so that anyone listening to this tape would have that documentation.
This would be, like I say, that's our squadron, so there's four squadrons in the group, too. Our group could be four times that.
Well, let me understand here. Did most groups tend to have just three squadrons?
Four squadrons.
For a B-26, it was four squadrons.
Four squadrons, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now, right here, here's March of 44. Okay, that's when we hit the U-boat pens, because that's my engineer, Pete Ogilvie, staff sergeant. Yeah. Engineer.
So that was that mission you were referring to, the reprisal raid, where were in a different aircraft than those other the crewmen you had typically flown with.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
To what extent did you incur losses due to non-operational causes? Non-combat causes. In other words, planes colliding due to weather or things of that nature.
Oh, very, very little. Hardly any that I know of, really, that I can say offhand. I just can't. We did have a couple of midairs on takeoff, basically. For one thing, we had one squadron that the squadron commander had the fellas pull their planes off. A B-26, they'd go down the runway and you get up speed and it flies off. But he would have them just haul back on the stick and pull them off, and they'd go along just mushing. And that way, maybe the guy behind him, and we'd take off just, like I say, three at a time on the runway. Well, that didn't give the fellow behind him much chance. If he was sitting there stuttering and he was running good, come up underneath him. And that happened a couple of times. Yeah.
Where one is mushing along and the other one's going,
just come right up,
coming
underneath
right up
him.
And then slam it.
Yeah.
And of course everyone's lost.
The both planes would go down. In fact, the one crash just about took out our mess hall. They all fell awful close to the mess hall.
And, of course, with you being based in England, and all your missions were flown out of the same base, is that correct?
Yeah, mm-hmm. Chipping Ongar.
Chipping Ongar,
uh-huh.
Yes.
Yeah.
And you flew a total of 75 combat missions, correct?
Well, six what they call sorties, dropping bombs, and nine diversion raids, which a diversion raid is the same really as a mission, only we didn't carry any bombs. We would go in ahead of like a B-17 group and fly over a couple of airfields to pull up the fighters so they'd chase us, and then we'd give them a run for the money and head back to England, and then the fighters would have to go back in and refuel, and about that time the B-17s would go over. So it was timed so that the fighters would be refueling when the B-17s went through. And we did that nine times on diversion raids.
So if I understand correctly, you had a tally then of 75 missions, including nine diversions?
Yeah, And 66 sorties and nine diversions, as we called it.
66 sorties, because you said the diversion did not mm-hmm. carry a bomb load, but the others, of course, the sorties,
that's dropped.
You had ordnance
yeah.
on
mm-hmm.
board.
Mm-hmm.
And And that period of combat time, you were flying combat from what month and year to what month and year?
From August to July.
August of
43 to July of 44. Yeah. First part of August to the end of July, 16th of July. Yeah.
And how did the requirement change for you in terms of how some crews initially had a certain number of missions that they had to fly, and then it was subsequently changed and increased?
The B-25s, B-17s, basically went in with a limit of 25 missions, and they were sent home. Ours was supposed to have been 50 missions. One of the first men to get his 50 missions, we were flying a crew one day and had a different mechanic on board. It was his 50th mission. And it was a kind of a tough mission, but we toughed it out and made it. We were about ready to abort it, but since it was his 50th mission, we ran it anyway, so he'd get his 50th mission. We thought he'd be on his way home. Well, they just ignored it. They called it 50 missions, and that was it. And so then I forget what mission it would have been. I probably had 50 or 55. And we were going on a leave in London one evening, and we used to meet our doctor there, a squadron doctor. He was quite a character. And Doc says, am I gonna see you at the Bees Club in London? I says, well, I don't think so, Doc. I said, anymore, I can't drink. I said, I tried to drink the other day and I just couldn't hold it. I just threw it up. I mean, I can't drink anything. He says, you're sick. He says, you gotta go to the hospital. So he sent me down to Southern England, to what they call the Miami Beach of England. It's not Miami Beach by a long, long ways, but it is nice. It was a nice hotel. And it was just kind of a rest and recuperation camp is what it was. And they called it a flack house is what it was, because if anybody, I've told some people, if they've ever seen the old movie 12 O'Clock High, where I forget who the main actor was now.
Gregory Peck,
I believe. Greg Peck. When he couldn't pull himself up into that B-17, that's how you feel. You don't have any strength. You can't hardly tie your shoestrings. And that's just how you go. So I went there then, and then because of that, when I got back to base, Doc says, well, in order to make it worthwhile, he says, you should fly a few more missions. So I did then. Probably, I think I flew about 6 missions or so after that. And so then what happened then too, see, this was July and after the invasion. So what was happening, our group was getting ready, but first they were going to France, but first they were going to a base in Southern England to kind of regroup and then go on to France. And what happened then, because of 2 or 3 of us that had a good many ambitions in, decided to send us home instead of making the move. So that's mainly how it's come I got to come home, because the group then left the base from England there and was going to Southern England to France.
So you mentioned you had, you said 6 missions after that rest and recreation center.
Mm-hmm.
And then you got to go home because you didn't have to make the move with the unit.
Yeah.
And the R&R period was roughly how long, I'm sorry? Did you say?
I was there probably a month.
A month?
I don't know if it was really that long, really, though. I don't know. Where am I here? Oh, that's 2. Let's go back here to where we are here. I can maybe tell by dates on this. I had my records. I don't know where my records are.
Well, okay, just here we ballpark a couple weeks or maybe.
There's 7 to 12.
Just curious how long of a timeout that was.
That's July. Well, here's June the 10th to July the 7th, evidently. Probably about then that I didn't fly, maybe. Because 2, 3, 4, 6, 7, 8, 10 in June.
Well, I'll have to see if I can't make some copies of that documentation that you're looking through, some of your service records, whatever you wouldn't mind furnishing, so that someone wondering what you're referencing can take a look themselves.
I don't know where those things might be on file. Someplace, probably, I guess. I don't know. You could find them or not. Someplace they'd be on file, I'm sure.
Well, Air Force Historical Research Agency, you never know what they might have. Well, or, of course, the National Records Center, the individual person's...
See, I'm still listed as Captain Air Force Reserve, retired.
Got out as a captain, okay.
Well, after I was out. I was in the reserve, see, for years.
At what point did you exit the reserves?
I'm still at. Still listed as a reserve.
Well, retired, but I meant as far as...
I don't know. See, when after I was married, we lived at Virginia there for a while, and I went to Jacksonville to a reserve unit. I was planning to build time for retirement, but then I took the job and was on the road, and I just couldn't make those meetings.
Well, let me understand here. You completed your combat tour in July of 44. You came back. And you came back to the States, and you were, I believe you said you had instructor duty for a time.
Yeah, I was, dates I'm not sure about.
Well, would you say you served active duty another couple of years, or?
My last flight was the 24th of May of 1945.
24 May of 45, last flight. So you got off of active duty.
Well, right after that, I was sent to Chicago and was given my release then. I mean, I didn't get a discharge. I'm not discharged.
Right, and then you went into the reserves until what year? When did you
Probably, well, we were married in 46. Let's see, I went to Ottawa in, when did we go to Ottawa? 50. I'm not sure. 55 or so.
You retired from the reserves.
Yeah. So. I quit going. I didn't really retire. I just quit going. That's all. I mean,
okay. So 55, you kind of hung
probably,
up the uniform, so to speak.
Yeah,
you were
no
longer drilling or anything.
No. Well, I never did. It was just a meeting we went to in Jacksonville. Because we were a non-active reserve unit.
So you didn't drill
in
the reserves?
No, and we didn't go to camps either, like some of them unit did. This was just an inactive reserve unit.
Well, you said you went to a meeting?
Once a month, one meeting a month.
One meeting a month in the reserve.
And then you could also, through correspondence, you could pick up some points, too. See, I forget now anymore what it was, but if you could get so many points a year, which would count like a year's time, and what I was trying to do, well, I ended up with like 11 years credit, I think. And see, if I could have gone for 20, why, I'd have gotten I'd be drawing about $1,200 a month now if I went 20 years, if I'd have gotten my 20 years in.
So you were... Between your active duty service of, let's see, you said you got out in about 45, so you were active duty
just under 4 years.
4 years.
From September 41 to July 45.
And then you had with the reserves about another 7 years of reserve
time.
Time for your 11, Okay. Now, just again, to try and sketch out your post-war time, you then came back, and aside from your reserve activities, you then went into the business world, or the working world, of the civilian working world, I should say.
Actually, when we were first married, we were on the farm with my dad, and also rented an aunt and a cousin's farm across the road from us. Well, then it came up that Connie's uncle was retiring from a real nice farm.
Now, you married Connie in 46.
46.
What was her maiden name?
Rose. Roost. R-O-O-S.
Ah, okay.
R-O-O-S. And her uncle was retiring, and he got the word some way that I wasn't too happy with my dad. Well, we just didn't have enough land for two people to live off of, for one thing. And he had a real nice farm at Chestnut over here, just south of us, you know, northwest of Decatur, and wanted to know if we would like to rent that. So we did. But about 2 years of that, well, let's see, we went there in 48, I guess, and then in 50, in riding tractors, well, I showed you that plane where we'd cracked up the Schwarzenegger, or the middleweight champ. I was standing up in
the nickname of the plane you
I was standing up.
Just to let someone know who's listening, that's where you had a mission where flak pierced the tires, but when you came into land, the pilots didn't realize that the air had gone out of one of the tires, and upon landing, well, of course, that didn't, you were lucky that that didn't get any worse than damaging the aircraft.
But because of that, as soon as I felt that the plane was pretty much out of control, well, I usually rode in the navigation compartment across the aisle from the radio operator, so I jumped up and was trying to open an escape hatch, which is right between us there. For some reason or other, I couldn't get the thing to open right, and about that time is when the plane spun off the runway, and I hit my back into the radio pretty hard. And otherwise, I didn't report it or anything at the time. It hurt for a few days. And now my turret gunner, he jumped out the back end, and it was still up in the air pretty good. He sprained an ankle as he jumped out, and he got a Purple Heart for it. But I just never did say much about it. But then because of this farming and riding a tractor, that was just bothering so much that I just had to give up farming. And that's when I went into the insurance business.
Would have been what year now? You gave up farming.
51.
Early 50s for sure.
Yeah,
all right.
51. Uh-huh.
Gave up farming around then. Mm-hmm. And then you proceeded to have a career in the insurance field for the remainder of your
till 85 I retired.
You retired. Yeah. And you were dealing with largely farming related insurance.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And you did that in central Illinois and into Wisconsin?
All over the central part, really. Some Indiana, basically a territory of Illinois and Wisconsin, and part of the time Iowa.
Midwest there.
And I have done quite a bit of work in Missouri and been out Colorado a time or two, and Nebraska. Yeah.
Until your retirement in
85.
And then since that time, how would you say your time has been spent?
Well, just like this morning, mowing the yard. And like I told Connie when I came in, my old dad always had an expression for that. He says, well, I made it look not quite so much like a widow woman lives here.
Well, at the age of 80, going out and mowing your yard, you certainly have a plenty spry. There's no dust gathering on you.
Well, I try to keep a little bit active. On that respect, I do yard work and fiddle around like that. But.
Well, now, of course, again, citing my summer internship, I know that have been affiliated with the Prairie Aviation Museum for some time, and your wife Connie is a marketing public relations person, a board of director. She is very active in the museum as well. So tell me about your role in the Prairie Aviation Museum here in Bloomington, Illinois, how long you've been involved with that, and what all that has involved.
It was quite odd because shortly after we moved back to Bloomington from Wisconsin, where we lived for 11 years.
Well, okay, you lived in Wisconsin 11 years, mm-hmm. and this was just roughly, again, if I can get an idea of the time period.
96.
So from 85 to 96, you retired.
Yeah, we've been
you retired in 85, and you were living.
We moved to Wisconsin then.
When you retired, you were living where?
Ottawa, Illinois.
Ottawa, Illinois. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Then you moved up to Wisconsin. Where in Wisconsin?
St. Germain.
St. Germain.
North part of Wisconsin.
And living up in God's country up there.
Fishing, snowmobiling.
Okay. Yeah. Uh-huh. Very good. St. Germain, Wisconsin. From 85 to 96, and then you moved here to Bloomington.
Mm-hmm.
And at what point did the Prairie Aviation Museum come in?
Okay, after we got here, I don't know, we'd heard something or kind of knew about it, and Connie decided to give Ron a membership for his birthday.
Your son?
Yeah, our
now,
son
you
Ron,
have,
yeah.
And your children are, or I should say, Ron,
Ron
someone knows
and,
your children's
Ron Carol, staff. Our daughter Carol, lives at Marseilles, Illinois. One reason we moved back to Bloomington because the kind of in between the kids, and it was just kind of a ways from them in Wisconsin. They enjoyed coming up, but we decided it was just not too good to be that far away. But anyway, then we gave Ron this membership for his birthday. And somewhere on the membership, they asked something or other about whether anybody was interested